So a couple weekends ago was our coffee house, and I got to sing a song from the musical Hamilton, which is all the rage on Broadway these days. I'm told that when I got up to sing, that Reverend Lee leaned over to Holly and said, "Ron is obsessed with Hamilton. He even used Hamilton at a staff devotion recently." And truth be told, I am obsessed with Hamilton. But I've got a lot of company. This musical is breaking all kinds of box office records. You cannot touch a ticket for years to come, and I mean years out. You can only buy tickets on the secondary market. And if I wanted to go see in a really bad seat, a poorly obstructed, partially obstructed seat, I'd still pay $500 or $600 for that ticket. The best tickets are selling for $3,000 right now. It has garnered 16 Tony nominations. Lin-Manuel Miranda, who both wrote and stars in Hamilton as the lead, he has already been given a MacArthur Genius Award last year and the Pulitzer Award this year. So amazing accolades and amazing critical acclaim, and the people are flocking to try to see this unlikely musical. Now, I say unlikely because it takes the story of Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers, but one of the lesser-known founding fathers, who did some pretty remarkable things. I mean, here's the guy who established the Coast Guard. This is the guy who established the New York Post. He wrote the Federalist Papers in defense of the Constitution as the Constitution was about to be adopted. He was the right-hand man to Washington during the Revolutionary War, became his Secretary of Treasury, helped establish a central bank, did all kinds of amazing things in his short life of 47 years before his life came to an end with a famous duel with Aaron Burr. That's right, we all know that part of the story. So what's amazing about this musical is that it tells all of those stories, all that rich history, in such a creative and powerful way. It uses rap, it uses hip-hop, and it uses very traditional Broadway genres, the ballads and love songs that you would think of as a Broadway musical, and has all of that, and has overlapping themes and incredible lyrics, and I am smitten. Even though I can't afford a ticket to go see it. If you want to go see it, it's coming to Washington, D.C., and when they start the tour in 2018. But to get tickets for that, you have to buy a season pass to the Kennedy Center this year and next year just to be eligible to have tickets for that. So I'm just putting it out there. This is my birthday wish list, okay? So anyway, the story culminates. It tells this dramatic story of how this immigrant from the West Indies comes and makes a name for himself during the Revolutionary War in that formative period of time. Gets married, betrays his wife. It's a powerful, powerful witness. They lose a son, and at the very end, after he dies at the hands of Aaron Burr, the last song that has all of the characters coming back on the stage is this: "Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?" Kind of a fitting thing to be thinking about on this Memorial Day weekend. And so I've been thinking about Memorial Day weekend and thinking about scriptures and how often that theme of remembrance and memorial comes up in the scriptures. Most often the word remember comes up in relation to the covenant of the people of God with God, and our call to remember that covenant and to be remembered by this God who never forgets us. It is in the story of Joshua crossing over the Jordan River, just like Moses had crossed the Red Sea with the people. Now Joshua gets to continue this journey to freedom and to the new land, and when they cross over the Jordan, there's a moment of memorial. He tells the 12 leaders, one from each of the 12 tribes, to go into the river, pick up a stone, and to place the stone as a memorial for the God's salvation that has brought them through the river into the promised land. "So these stones shall be to the Israelites a memorial forever. When your children ask you about God's redeeming love, about God's salvation, you'll have these stones to remember, to mark it." And we've been marking memorials for a long time, haven't we? Sacred spaces, sacred places. The text from the New Testament gospel comes toward the very end of Matthew's gospel. In this case, it's not a place so much that is remembered as a person. This is a woman who comes to Jesus right before he is about to be turned over to the authorities, right before he is about to be crucified and die and to be resurrected. And in this poignant moment, she takes very expensive ointment from a jar, an alabaster jar, and she pours it over Jesus. And the disciples are indignant. They are irate. They said, why was this not sold and the money given to the poor? And Jesus says, you do not realize the love and the devotion that she has poured out on me. She has anointed my body for burial. And here are the closing words of that story. Truly, I tell you, wherever this good news, and he's talking about the good news of his life and his death and his resurrection, wherever this good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done for me will be told in remembrance of her. This will be her remembrance, this act of devotion and loyalty and commitment. This weekend in Washington, D.C., I'm sure you'll see scenes like this many times over. People going to touch the Vietnam Memorial Wall. If any of you have been there, and that's a very holy, sacred place. There will be motorcyclists who have been coming and invading the city all weekend long. When we used to live in D.C., they would be riding up and down 270 and all around the Beltway all weekend long, ready for that ride of remembrance, that ride for healing. I saw one of them interviewed this week. He says, we don't just come back to remember, we come back to heal. We have so many scars that we still need to heal from. So part of the way we heal is by remembering. We come back to remember. I read an article a couple years ago that showed up in the Washington Post, and it really touched me. It was called Washington's Other Monuments. It was a story of a photographer, Lloyd Wolfe, who I then got to meet, and I got to talk to him about this project. What Lloyd Wolfe would do was not to go to the big glitzy places, the Washington Monument and the Wall and the World War II Memorial and all those wonderful places of memorial that are in D.C., but what he devoted his life to doing very quietly, very behind the scenes kind of way for about 20 years was he would read the stories about young lives that were taken too early in Washington, D.C. These were young, mostly African-American men that were dying on the streets, literally, in the drug battles and in the violence of the gangs. And these were not always front page news because, well, it was just happening all the time. But he felt like somebody needed to know their stories too. And so he would go around and he would take pictures of the shrines that would pop up, these little memorials, the stones that were placed, if you will. And there would be stuffed animals and bottles and candles and pictures. And he took pictures and he put them on a blog so that families could see them and so people could communicate and connect with each other. People could heal and remember these lives and these lives that mattered and needed to be memorialized as well. And I remember when I talked to him, we talked about how these memorials and how his photographs really were like prayers of lament. These were prayers of lament offered on behalf of these young lives, a time of remembrance. I want to tell you another story today, what comes to my heart this Memorial Day weekend. And it's my father's life, my father who gave his life not in uniform, though he was an Air Force ROTC when he was in college, but didn't die in the service. His only Air Force service was at a desk in Pittsburgh for a couple of years as he fulfilled his commitment there. But my dad grew up pouring out devotion to his family and to me and my brother and my sister. He worked for 37 years for the same company, for Prudential Life Insurance. Somebody came out of church today and said, I worked for 37 years for the same company before I retired. That doesn't happen much anymore. And he worked in personnel, and so he was there at the time of affirmative action. And so we would have conversations around our dinner table about what it meant to respect the dignity of every single person, whatever their economic background or their ethnic status was. It really didn't matter, and we were taught that you should love and care for everyone, treat them with dignity. And he brought home friends, African-American friends who would come to our table, and we'd have conversations about race, and we'd have conversations about inclusion. And those lessons impacted me greatly, and I'm so grateful to my dad for teaching me to love unconditionally, to love without boundaries, to love anybody who is God's child. It's just one of the many gifts that he gave. He also was a Little League coach. He showed up, and he actually coached, I think, Holly's brother at one point, was one of the coaches on the team there, coached me for many years, came to every one of my my soccer games and basketball games and my sister's tennis matches and my brother's games. He would take off work early, and he was always there, and so grateful for that. But one of the last acts of his life is what leaves such an impression on me, and I find myself thinking about on this weekend when we remember those who gave their lives for others. I was on a volunteers and mission trip in Illinois doing some flood relief work when I got the phone call from my sister. My mom and my dad had gone to Ocean City, New Jersey, which is a place they loved. Matter of fact, we kids had paid for a vacation for them to go down there. And so there they were, their first day of vacation. They'd gotten there late in the day, and so they had gone to the beach, and they were sitting reading on the beach. They loved that time of day. I still love that time of day as well. Lifeguards had gone off duty, and there were two girls out on boogie boards who got caught in a rip current, and no one else was around. So my dad went in the water after them to try to help rescue them. And he was in pretty deep, and he was able to get them to a point where, by this point, some other people had gotten involved and sort of hand them off to somebody else who got them in the rest of the way to the shore. But when they turned around, they realized that my father was struggling, and he was not doing well, and he began to drown himself. And they sort of literally formed a human chain over these rock jetties on the Ocean City 12th Street beach there. So I went back for a day of remembrance, a day of recollecting, and my Sabbath leave back in 2010 took these pictures, because I wanted to sit there and feel the spirit of my dad on that beach. My dad never came out of a coma. He was in a coma for 6 weeks and then died finally in that September. And all the while, when my sister and I and my brother and my mom would go visit in the hospital, no one ever called him Dick Foster or Richard Foster. The nurses simply referred to him as the hero. The hero's over in room 602. And it's one of the lasting legacies that my father leaves me and left us as a family. It didn't surprise any of us that he went in the water, even though he was not probably physically capable of saving those girls. His heart was stronger than his body. And we are grateful for that last witness that he left us, even if it meant that he left our lives way too soon. I was only 33 when he died. And our kids really never got to know him fully as their grandfather. He would have been a fabulous grandfather for them. And so I find myself thinking and giving God thanks about his life, giving God thanks for his witness. It's a day this weekend when we reflect back on our lives and what will our legacy be. In the closing scene of Hamilton, all of these characters from his life come forward. And George Washington starts that final scene and begins to sing, "Let me tell you what I wish I'd known. When I was young and dreamed of glory, you have no control." And then they all join in, "Who lives, who dies, who tells your story." And Angelica, his sister-in-law, claims every other founding father's story gets told, every other founding father gets to grow old. And Aaron Burr then sings next, "But when you're gone, who remembers your name? Who keeps your flame? Who tells your story?" And so there's this haunting reflection at the end of his life, "Who tells your story?" And they come out and powerfully tell the story of Hamilton's life. It was not glory that he hoped to achieve in battle, which is what he hoped for. But it was a mark that he left in so many other ways on the world and in so many people's lives. And my father's mark was not left in battle either. It was left in a very ordinary day at the beach that turned into an opportunity to literally give his life for someone else. And as I think about his life, and I think about the opportunities that God gives us to leave a legacy, to leave a story worth telling, I think about Jay's witness to us today, about a life that's been turned around and reclaimed and put on a different path. And I think about all of our opportunities to be used by God for good things in this world, for transformation and for love and for mercy. Because we will all die and we will all be gone one day. But who will tell your story? And what will they say? What story will they tell? Thanks be to God. Amen.